Welcome to Expert Voices of Government Contracting Show, produced and underwritten by Kroll and Mooring, which is solely responsible for the content. Guests and topics are chosen by the host and underwriter, with no input from Federal News Radio. This show was created to discuss the selling of goods and services to the government, whether federal, state, local, or foreign. Selling to the government presents businesses with tremendous opportunities, but also significant challenges and risks. Each show will cover a wide variety of topics related to government contracting, underwritten exclusively by Kroll and Mooring. Now here's your show host.
Welcome to Expert Voices of Government Contracting. I'm your host, Peter Ayer. I'm a partner in Kroll & Mooring's Government Contracts Practice, and I'm joined today by three of my colleagues, and I'll ask them to introduce themselves.
Hi, I'm Gail Zirkelbach. I am also a partner at Kroll & Mooring in the Government Contracts Group out of our Los Angeles office, and I spend a lot of my time conducting internal investigations for clients around the world and also helping them structure their own internal investigations.
I'm Phil Nglima. I'm a partner in Kroll & Mooring's White Collar and Regulatory Enforcement Group, and I work closely with many of our subject matter experts and other practice groups conducting investigations, regulatory disclosures, and defending enforcement actions brought by the federal government.
And I'm Bob Rode. I'm a partner in the Government Contracts Group, and I co-lead the False Claims Act practice, and I also assist government contractors and other entities in connection with government investigations and False Claims Act litigation.
And we're here today to talk about investigations. At Kroll & Mooring, we have about 500 attorneys, and the vast majority of our attorneys at Kroll & Mooring conduct investigations. And investigations come in all different shapes and sizes, all different industries, and we have had experience in many of those industries. And when we talk about investigations, it's important to keep in mind that it can mean a lot of different things. They can be very big, they can be very small. At the end of the day, investigations are about trying to figure out answers to questions, resolve concerns, and really get to the bottom of issues that come up. So to start with, Gail, can you talk a little bit about how an investigation can be triggered, focusing on the internal factors that can give rise to an investigation?
Sure, Peter. There are numerous ways that you could learn of an issue that warrants an investigation coming from within your own organization. One of the more obvious internal sources will be your internal hotline. And some hotline calls might raise less than credible claims and allegations that really don't merit an investigation. Oftentimes, there will be an internal hotline call which will be the first indication that there is a potential problem within the organization. Therefore, any of these types of hotline tips would need to be assessed and evaluated to determine if further investigation is necessary. And then depending on the severity of the allegation, the type of investigation that would be warranted. Another source of tips that can come internally are exit interviews. When an employee is getting ready to leave the company and is being interviewed, sometimes they are more likely to be frank and express their concerns of problems that they have observed during their employment. Again, these tips need to be investigated, although the circumstances under which the employee is leaving the organization needs to be factored into any analysis of the credibility of the allegations. It's going to be very important for organizations to have a mechanism for ensuring that individuals who conduct exit interviews transmit legitimate concerns raised during those interviews to appropriate individuals who can then assess the need to investigate those concerns. Similarly, an organization needs to watch for postings on social media where employees could be posting complaints or allegations of a problem within the organization. A final important internal source of information leading to investigations are reports made by employees to their supervisors. To ensure that this is a fruitful source, supervisors need to be trained to create an environment when every employee feels comfortable raising concerns to them. In addition, they also need to understand to whom they need to report concerns in order for an appropriate investigation to occur. Employees need to understand the importance of raising concerns to their supervisors and feel comfortable that those concerns will be properly elevated and investigated. Employees also need to understand that if they don't feel comfortable going to their direct supervisor, they can go to a higher-up supervisor or through the hotline or another ethics officer.
Great. So those are some of the internal ways that we see complaints or concerns being raised that can trigger an investigation. Bob, what about some of the external factors that can lead a company to kick off an investigation?
Sure. Thanks, Peter. Probably the worst way to become aware externally of an investigation would be a criminal grand jury subpoena. But that is certainly one of the ways that companies become aware of pending governmental investigations. There's also administrative subpoenas that are issued. Usually those are limited to requesting documents. But if you do receive a subpoena from an agency, I think typically the substance of that would put you on notice of a pending government investigation. And then there's civil investigative demands that are issued by various agencies. Those are typically investigative in nature, and they're broader in some respects than subpoenas. And those are usually utilized by the government in early stages before the Department of Justice, for example, would file an actual complaint. Other ways would include customer or agency inquiries, informal in nature. And by customer, it would be the agency itself who's the customer of the company seeking information about a particular issue. Outside auditors that the company uses could also raise questions, or governmental auditing agencies. And then, as Gail mentioned, there's the media, of course, where the media may be asking you questions that could be either in tandem with an ongoing investigation of some sort, or social media. If you're a publicly held company, there could be shareholder issues or inquiries that are made that could trigger an investigation. Also, in the context of government contracting, there are competitors that could be raising issues in connection, for example, with a bid protest proceeding that could raise issues that could trigger an investigation. And then there are congressional inquiries made by committees with jurisdiction over government contractors, where they can request documents or information that could be related to something that could give rise to an investigation. And then lastly, I would say suspension and debarment officials who make inquiries to your company, those are things that could be all related to a potential government investigation.
So in your experience, Bob and Phil and Gail, what's the most common way that you've seen in your practice an issue come up that then would lead you to advise a client that it's time to start an investigation? So Phil, what in your practice, what do you see as the most common way that an investigation comes up?
Well, we often have contact from the government early in the process, whether it is the type of informal civil investigative demand that Bob mentioned, or a more readily enforceable subpoena, something giving rise to either notice that there is a pending investigation or perhaps a civil suit like a QI-TAM action that is propelling the current investigation.
And Gail, what about in your practice?
Similar to what Phil just said, oftentimes it'll be an employee coming in and saying that the government officials have approached him or her and wanted to interview them about a certain issue. And that's the first time that a company will be aware that the government is looking into certain allegations.
And Bob?
So my experience is that, as similar to Gail's, in that it'll either be an employee has contacted higher ups at a company saying they were contacted by someone in the government asking questions, or obviously a hotline complaint, also obviously any kind of administrative subpoena or CID.
So, Phil, if you're now in a situation where concerns have been raised through any of the mechanisms that we've talked about, and you believe that it's time to start the process of gathering information, at that point, is it an investigation?
When you are trying to get at the facts, you're investigating. And the thing that you have to bear in mind is that the government, if it isn't already involved, when the government later is reviewing what you've done, they're going to want to assess the adequacy, the rigor, the diligence that you applied to that. As we talk about what's the appropriate way to scale and approach an investigation, we have to be mindful of the current enforcement climate that we're in. And that was really redefined a month ago by a memorandum issued by Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates, who basically, following on the criticism, I think, that the government has received in recent years for the lack of individual accountability through the recession and the economic enforcement actions that have followed it, the government is now responding by saying, while you might think that some companies are too big to prosecute, no individual is too small to prosecute. And we are going to be looking at all investigations to see whether they have provided the government the basis to decide, should there be criminal enforcement, should there be civil enforcement, and should it be not just leveled at the companies or organizations, but also at individuals. And so the Yates Memorandum, as it's been called in our arena, is really a way of sending a message to the Justice Department attorneys, but more effectively, really, to the industry, to the rest of the legal community, that what the government is now looking for is a clear indication that every investigation has brought forward and volunteered to the government those facts that help the government to decide on what form of enforcement to bring. And there should be no possibility of the government believing that there's either been some whitewash or some light take on the facts. They want to hear about individual action. They want to be able to propel their civil and criminal enforcement attorneys into a dialogue from the very outset to assess which side, or should both sides in some instances be moving in unison and concurrently. And they also want to have information from the company about how high up the problem, the transgression may have gone. So the Yates Memorandum takes what has been a longstanding policy of the government, which is we always look at both individuals and organizations. And it has been much more granular about what's expected of the prosecutors and the companies that are disclosing to them and negotiating with them along the way. No one's going to get credit for having either appropriately cooperated with the government or having cleaned up their own act if they don't provide this level of near transparent information to the government. That, of course, has huge implications for how we scale and style our investigations. We have to consider at the very outset, do we think criminal enforcement is likely? Are we trying to protect privilege? Are we trying to maintain as much independence as possible? And should that mean that the investigators are reporting to an independent committee of the board or to management? All of these have been issues that we always have looked at in this context, but now they are defining. If the government isn't satisfied that rapidly the company has come forward with facts, made them available to the government, and acted on them, holding individuals accountable internally at the company and putting in place systems that will respond going forward, the government simply won't give any credit to the company for whatever actions it has taken.
Thank you very much, Phil. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Expert Voices of Government Contracting on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Selling goods and services to the government, whether federal, state, local, or foreign, presents businesses with tremendous opportunities, but also significant challenges and risks. On Expert Voices of Government Contracting Show, underwritten by Kroll and Mooring, you'll hear from principals in the Government Contracts Group discussing effective legal guidance in this highly complex arena. The size, scope, and depth of the knowledge of the Government Contracts Group are unparalleled and span every facet of litigation, counseling, and transactions. Visit Kroll.com to learn more.
Welcome back to Expert Voices of Government Contracting on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We just heard from my colleague Phil Nglima about formulating an investigation plan. Now I'm going to turn it over to Bob Rode to talk more broadly about the coordination of remedies among government enforcement agencies.
Thank you, Peters. So in the past, there really wasn't that much coordination. Prior to 2012, anyway, most False Claims Act cases, for example, would make their way to the Department of Justice through a QI-TAM complaint or a whistleblower complaint. And only if the civil attorney at DOJ thought it appropriate would they refer the matter for criminal review. That all changed, however, around 2012 when then Attorney General Eric Holder issued a memorandum, which is colloquially referred to as the Holder Memorandum, instructing civil and criminal investigators to share information, quote, to the fullest extent appropriate to the case and permissible by law. It was clear that there was a new imperative being placed on the coordination between civil and criminal to make sure that to the extent there is a criminal exposure for a company, that be investigated at the earliest stages. That was not really placed into a formal policy aside from the memorandum until in 2014, there was a DOD instruction, which is 7050.05, issued on May 12, 2014. And pursuant to that instruction, which is referred to or called the Coordination of Remedies for Fraud and Corruption Related to Procurement Activities, each DOD component is required to monitor from its inception all significant investigations of fraud and corruption related to procurement activities affecting its organization. And so basically what the government has done is it's made KTAM enforcement, False Claims Act enforcement, something that will, from at least 2014 forward, move on parallel tracks. Now, the instruction provides a range of remedies, if you will, for the agencies, and it's really split up into two courses. The first course allows an agency who believes that a contractor has committed fraud to dispense with a very formal process before changing the contractual terms and allowing that contractor to be able to go to alternative contractors to procure goods and services. The second course really involves the fact that at the inception, DOJ will be reviewing issues both criminally and civilly, and if there is a reason to do so, the Department of Justice will pursue criminal action. And so with respect to the False Claims Act, as we've heard from the Supreme Court recently and from other courts, the FCA is not intended to be used as a broad anti-fraud tool. As the Supreme Court said in the Allison Engine case, it's not an all-purpose fraud statute. But what we do know is that with respect to enforcement, the Department of Justice going forward is going to be pursuing any kind of procurement fraud case, both criminally and civilly. In short, while the coordination by DOJ's civil and criminal divisions to investigate whistleblower allegations under the FCA and other statutes is not new, it's clear that they've refocused their efforts, and organizations, individuals, and attorneys involved in civil investigations should therefore be aware of the real possibility of a parallel criminal civil investigation and the issues that will arise. And lastly, I would simply note that what you won't hear likely from an investigator is whether there is a criminal investigation proceeding as they approach you about a civil investigation of fraud.
And so as a practical matter, what that often means is when you're coming up with your investigation plan, you should be assuming that at various points along the way, there may be new players, new stakeholders. So all of that should be thought about at the outset. One of the other things that's important to think about at the outset is privilege. And do you want this to be a privileged investigation? How do you protect the privilege and things of that along those lines? And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Gail to talk about privilege and some of the recent developments that we've seen in that arena.
Thank you, Peter. Optimally, you want to consider whether or not an internal investigation should be conducted under the attorney-client privilege, which protects communications between attorneys and clients from discovery, to retain the most flexibility within that investigation. If you don't start an investigation under the privilege, you can't later claim it. And if you do originally choose to start a privileged investigation, you can always later choose to waive that privilege. Traditionally, keeping investigatory materials privileged was relatively simple, and the privilege itself was considered sacrosanct. All that was called into question last year with the D.C. Circuit's decision in the Barco KBR case. Now, although that initial decision, which questioned the sanctity of the privilege in an investigation, was overturned, and the privilege remains alive and well, after Barco and other recent cases, it's important to be aware of the specific factors that courts examine to determine whether or not to preserve the privilege and to take certain precautions to protect the privilege. First and most importantly, it is essential to make clear from the outset of the investigation that the purpose of the investigation is to provide legal advice and to document that legal purpose before beginning the investigation. There can be a subsidiary business person purpose to the investigation, but the primary purpose must be for legal advice. It's also essential that investigations are conducted by or at the active direction of attorneys. If you do choose to use non-attorney agents to conduct the investigation, make sure the legal purpose of their activities is contemporaneously documented and their work is being done at the direction of attorney. Similarly, ensure a significant purpose of all communications during the investigation that you want to protect is a legal purpose. Before every interview, make sure and give a proper Upjohn warning to the interviewee and to document that the warning was provided. Don't try to be cute and modify the language. Use the specific language that has been specified. If your investigation has foreign aspects, keep in mind that the relevant privilege principles that apply in those jurisdictions and conduct your investigation accordingly. Make sure also that you don't inadvertently waive the privilege by making certain arguments in the litigation that could open the door to a broader waiver argument. You can't use privilege as both a sword and a shield. And remember that you will have the burden of proving that the privilege exists. So therefore, your entire investigative plan should reflect the ways that you intend to keep the privilege intact unless and until you later choose to waive it.
Thank you, Gail. One of the other things that we think is very important along the way is to think about external notifications to customers and government stakeholders. These sort of notifications or disclosures generally fit into two different categories. There are mandatory disclosures and voluntary or discretionary disclosures. So depending on the type of matter that you're dealing with, it is important to, at the correct and appropriate point along the way, assess whether the company should or must give notice to the government. Those notifications tend to be to entities like inspectors general, suspension and debarment officials, or customers. So, for example, if there are critical safety issues, there may be mandatory disclosures to the customer on an expedited basis. If there is credible evidence of fraud, there may be mandatory disclosure to an IG or to an SDO. So these are all things that have to be thought through. As a general matter, these disclosure regimes contemplate that you will be making disclosures well before an investigation is complete. So at Kroll & Mooring, we oftentimes think through whether it's appropriate to give a preliminary or a placeholder notification that an investigation is underway. That oftentimes is a very appropriate step to take. Obviously, it's important to be mindful of some of the things that Bob and Phil and Gail have talked about in terms of preserving privilege and being mindful of some of the other stakeholders that may be at play. But particularly where an investigation is in flight, it is important to be mindful that these sort of notifications oftentimes need to happen under your contract or under the Cognizant regulations before an investigation is complete. Another thing that often has to happen before an investigation is complete is giving thought to corrective actions. If something has gone wrong or something can or should be done better in the future, are there steps that a company can or must take as a responsible contractor, as a responsible corporate citizen, by way of corrective action or remedial action? So Phil, in your experience, what's the right time to start thinking about corrective action? Do you wait until the end of the investigation? Does it happen at the beginning? Talk through the timing and the content of that corrective action.
Peter, that's an important issue to be wrestled with right at the outset. And really what it boils down to is when you're doing an investigation, you want to find out what happened and why. And when you're facing the government, you're going to be talking about that as a root cause analysis. Have we drilled down to figure out what individual actions gave rise to the problem and whether or not we had a systems breakdown that permitted or didn't anticipate that potential problem? So on those two levels, you have to be looking at the individual accountability, which is, of course, going to help you to address the government's very real concern right now about being able to hold individuals responsible, but also make your own internal decisions about what that means in terms of termination decisions or reassignment or retraining of individuals who are involved. And to be able to look up and down the ranks and from side to side to assess how many people were involved, who were the managers, who were the supervisors, who should have been aware of this issue. And then, of course, requiring those individuals to likewise be cooperative with the government during the pending investigation. The system remediation side of it is going to be more at the tail end of it, but you have to be aware as you're going through the investigation that you will be getting there, that you will be looking at whether or not we had adequate practices and policies, whether they were truly enforced, whether a climate had been created where people knew that they had to abide by them. That all goes to the point of, is this something likely to happen again? And if it is something that could have gotten through our systems before, what changes are needed to ensure it simply can't be tolerated or permitted again?
And Gail, finally, can you talk about the importance of compliance programs and how they fit into this overlay of investigations?
Sure. Of course, your goal all along is to avoid investigations or to make sure that they are done properly. To that end, you have to have a focus on compliance and a strong ethics program. The key is to have a culture of compliance that comes down from the top of the organization. The C-suite has to be engaged, talk the talk, and walk the walk. Reporting of problems or potential problems has to be encouraged among employees. The fact that retaliation is not tolerated must be very clear. And it's very important to ensure that there is appropriate follow-up to when allegations are raised.
Thank you very much, Gail. So on behalf of my colleagues at Kroll & Mooring, I want to thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to Expert Voices of Government Contracting on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any portion of the show, you can listen to the show in its entirety and on demand at federalnewsradio.com, keyword Kroll.
Thank you for listening to Expert Voices of Government Contracting Show, produced and underwritten by Kroll and Mooring, which is solely responsible for the content. Guests and topics are chosen by the underwriter with no input from Federal News Radio. Each show will cover a wide variety of topics related to government contracting, underwritten exclusively by Kroll and Mooring. The next show will be Thursday, November 19th at 12:30 p.m. on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.